It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervie. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening, Los Angeles. I am Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law. And I am so happy to welcome back with me this week, because I had the pleasure last week of working with Leanne Tweeden.
How are you?
Famous of McIntyre in the Morning and Dr. Drew.
How are you? You look good in Dr. Blue.
You keep asking me how I am. I am ecstatic. We just got off the field. I know this is what's wonderful about radio is I can wear anything and no one can see what I'm wearing. I'm wearing Dodger blue.
Matches your blue eyes.
Thank you. Yep. It's because my son's team, Hudson, it's the Dodgers.
I love it.
And we just got off of a 13-5 victory. I have the game ball in my hand. Hudson Gervie, spring 22, AA Dodgers. Outstanding pitching. Yes, he went 3 innings, 8 strikeouts.
Ooh,
8
great.
Out of 9 outs.
Great.
Strikeouts. So,
we were at
congrats.
A kid's birthday party and they had a kickball tournament. That was fun. It was great
a
weather.
A kickball tournament?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the son of their athletic coach at school. So it was a lot of fun. Kids were just kicking the ball. My daughter had a great kick into the outfield.
Was the coach scouting to see who was going to be the athlete for the high school?
I mean, they were second graders. It was like 6, 7, 8 year olds, but maybe.
Well,
yeah. Who's got a good leg?
Who's got a good leg? We've got to let out a secret. Our kids go to the same school fortuitously. We didn't know that.
True. We did not know that. It's funny
and,
how the world works.
I happen to know some of the people you're talking about. Yeah. So, yes, they are fine coaches at our kids' school.
Yeah.
And they're in the same grade, actually. Actually, my daughter, Harper. Who's a softball player.
And a violinist with my son.
And a violinist. That's and right. We found out, and I'm going to introduce our special guest today, but we found out that he has a special interest in softball because he has a daughter who was a phenomenal softball player.
Incredible.
Who probably could have walked on at Harvard, but decided to go to Yale instead.
Oh, yes.
What a choice. Harvard, Yale, play softball, don't play softball. I'm sure she made the right choice. So let's talk a little bit about Mike Feuer. Mike Feuer has been the Los Angeles City Attorney since July 2013. I think you were elected in 2012. And took office as Los Angeles City Attorney in 2013. He previously served 3 terms in the California State Assembly, representing the 42nd Assembly District. He was a member of the Los Angeles City Council. That's important, City Council. I'm wearing Dodger blue, and I have my Rams mask, world champions.
Boop,
no one else is wearing a mask, just me. But I am showing my Los Angeles colors. Mike served as the executive director of Beth Sedek Legal Services, which protects the rights of the underserved and the unserved. He is a candidate for the 2022 Los Angeles mayoral election, so he's got that going for him. He got his bachelor's degree from Harvard, his law degree from Harvard. He served, and this is a legal show, I want to remind you, Leanne.
Yes.
He served as a judicial clerk to Justice Joseph Grodin of the California Supreme Court. Not easy to be a clerk at Supreme Court.
Wow.
Practiced with 2 law firms in California, taught at UCLA School of Law, and this is what's really important. His greatest accomplishment, it just might be that he has made a birthday card or a holiday card since he was 5 years old, continuously making birthday cards, making holiday cards.
It's pretty awesome.
That is something. Mike Feuer, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Welcome.
Alan and Leanne, it's great to be here. Do I owe you now a handmade birthday card? Because when you've done that for like 50 years, that's a lot of original ideas.
I think you need to make me one because I'm a craft person. I'm
oh,
one
I
of those
see.
People. See, I have a craft desk in my house.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I got the Cricut. I make handmade stuff all the time. So you're kind of a man after my own heart. I had no idea that, about that.
Fair enough. Yeah, you. Because this mayoral gig is really secondary to the making of cards.
That's cramping your style when it comes to crafting.
That's right. It's getting in the way
yes.
of this artistic activity.
That takes time to craft things by hand.
Well, in all seriousness, yeah. Mike, though, because you talk about that, we know about this accomplishment of making cards.
Yes.
But we have to ask you something. What are you most proud of? Look at all the stuff that I listed. All kinds of accomplishments. What are you most proud of?
You know, It's an interesting question, and I've never thought about that exactly. I think I'm most proud of the fact that I have the privilege of being able, throughout my career, to stand up for people who have no one to stand up for them and to make the world better. You know, just very seriously for a second, I do want to say that, you know, we all have family backgrounds that have done a lot to inspire what our values are. My dad was a prisoner of war to the Nazis in World War II. Barely survived that experience. He was a public school educator for 60 years.
Wow.
And, you know, when I was an athlete as a kid, I was throwing to him one day as a young high school student, and I asked him why he chose that job, and he told me in more detail than he previously had what it was like to be in Stalag 17, about which they made the very famous movie. Being Jewish in a Nazi prisoner of war camp was horrific, but the essence of the point to me was, at the end of the war, the Russians were coming to liberate the camp, and my father couldn't walk because he had parachuted from his plane that was shot down, and he landed too hard, and the Nazis wouldn't give him boots that fit. So my dad said, picture a long line of POWs marching across Austria in the snow. My dad said, look, I was like a half mile behind them, holding onto a little cart for stability, with a guard who could have shot me at any time. Wow. No one would have heard the sound. But he said to me, look, I didn't think I lived through that. When I did survive, I decided I'd do the most important work in the world, and that was kids. So he became an educator in public schools for 6 decades.
But what you're not saying is, in his education, he really focused on life lessons. We have a lot of teachers, and Leanne and I talk about the teachers all the time because our kids are in the same school.
How important they are, yeah.
But when you talk about your dad, Mel, you're talking about someone who really focused on life lessons, not just academia.
You know, it's very special that you said that, because one of the things that Alan's referring to is that after my dad's compensated career as an educator, he volunteered for 25 years in public schools. And he did this really neat thing. He came into schools in a program called Community Circle, and I saw him do this with fourth and fifth graders. He'd come in and he'd talk with them about important life lessons, like, what do you do if your friend is being bullied on the playground, but you're scared of the bully too? Or what if someone asks you to help them cheat on the homework? How do you respond? Or what if your dad is hitting your mom and you have no one to talk to? How do you grapple with those issues? And I saw this incredibly diverse array of kids he would talk to, jumping out of their skin to participate. You know, often we see sullen kids who are kind of not so interested in the lessons.
Right. Sure.
This was remarkable. And my dad has, we have at home now, you would have loved my father, 25 years worth of loose leaf letters to my dad saying how he changed the life of this young child. But in terms of a legacy, that's my dad's legacy. And my own is, I hope that by the time I'm done with public service, that people say, you know, lives were better in a meaningful way because I was able to do something or another. I've been focused, as you know, on issues that range from public safety to healthcare to access to justice for people, to the environment, just a huge array of issues. All that matters to me, really, in my life is my family and making the world better. And there's very little else that counts.
Well, that's a great answer for what are you most proud of. I don't think you really thought about it, but as you started speaking, it became real. And one of the things you did leave out, and I'm going to give you a chance to fill in the blank, your mother, Stella, she had a huge influence in what you're saying for a different reason than your father.
Now, that's right. You've done a lot of reading. So
no one's ever accused me of not being prepared on this show. But in 9 years, I know what I'm doing.
Well, I will say, yeah, my mom, who's still alive, my father passed away 6 years ago, but my mom is still alive at 90. And she grew up in Boyle Heights. When she was growing up in Boyle Heights, it was the quintessential melting pot in Los Angeles. She used to kid with us, you know, I spoke Russian, Yiddish, Spanish, and a little bit of English growing up. But she said, when I was a young boy, maybe 7, 8 years old, she made it clear how it felt when all her Japanese-American friends were suddenly gone, because our country had, at the beginning of World War II, incarcerated them in places like Manzanar. And she made very clear to us, you need to stand up for people who have no one standing with them. Now, when I was little, it was more like, you know, the kid on the playground who's getting picked on. But that lesson, as I got older, merged with my father's lessons about kind of the urgency of making something matter for other people. really those became touchstones for me in my life. And I know that I can sound like kind of a corny guy about these issues, but I think that values really count. And I'm just so lucky to have grown up in a family where I was instilled with these values.
Yeah, we only have a minute before we take the break, but it's interesting you say that because I remember the first time that Gloria Allred was on the show. She's been on the show many times, but I asked her a pointed question. I was real nervous I was going to say this. I promised myself I'm going to ask her. People call you a media whore. Does that bother you? And she didn't flinch. Just like you're speaking right now, she just said, I stand up for people who can't stand up for themselves. I give them a voice when they don't have a voice. I don't care what anyone calls me.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, in our city right now, there's a real need for leadership, I think, that brings people together, but that also is very practical and gets things done, and that recognizes when people who are very vulnerable need help, and also realizes that in our whole city, I think everybody right now feels on edge, diminished, like we need to do better. And I think we need to be impatient about addressing those issues. Standing up for people takes many different forms. And that's why I'm running for mayor.
And we have to take a break, but that's a great transition. You have said that the city of Los Angeles is in crisis. When we come back, we're going to ask Mike Feuer why he said that and what he plans to do to address it. You're listening to Gurvey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. Sometimes I feel like my only friend is the city I live in, the city of angel.
Lonely supposed to talk? I can't. Not when this is playing. I gotta listen. Leanne, who sings this?
Chili Peppers.
And were you there 3 years ago at our school?
But I did see the video.
I was there. I loved it. What am I talking about?
Well,
the Chili Peppers
the drummer, his kid goes to our school, right?
Yeah. And they played. You can imagine.
It's all over the internet.
They call us in to the school. They have this Halloween little party.
October bash or whatever.
Whatever it is. Yeah. And we're sitting there. I'm just sitting in my seat. You know, my kids are dressed up. I have two of them there. One was dressed up as from The Greatest Showman, the master of ceremonies. My daughter was
Elsa
little,
or something?
No, Little Bo Peep.
Oh, yeah. Cute.
From Toy Story.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the Chili Peppers play.
Oh, yeah.
And the kids don't have a clue. You know, they're seven and eight years old.
The parents were going crazy.
And we were going crazy. Yeah. They were all dressed up. They were dressed. One was a skeleton. One was like a pope.
Oh my gosh, go look online. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you look online and you look at YouTube, I guarantee you're going to love it.
Yeah.
It's at, can I say the name of the school or shouldn't I? Maybe I won't. Go look it up. The Chili Peppers playing at elementary school.
Yeah.
But that's not the best thing to see on the internet these days. If you're on YouTube, that's the second best thing. The best thing is Mike Feuer's best friend video, the mustache. Narrated by Jason Alexander. I guarantee you've got to see it. If you're listening right now, stop your car, pull over. Get on YouTube, and this is amazing. I love that video. I've watched it like four times.
I need to watch it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you gave away a little bit of the secret. But yes, my mustache, which I've had since 1977, does play a pivotal role in the video.
And the reason I gave it away was because it sounds like it's just some dull political ad if I don't say what it is.
Yeah.
This is the mustache. You cannot miss this. You have to see. I mean, some of the words, I don't know who wrote it, but, you know, the straining of the soup and of that stuff. But it's very informative. It tells who you are. It gives your heart.
Right.
As well as all your accomplishments.
And Jason Alexander is great.
Well, actually, you know, I wanted to have a video that wasn't the typical campaign video that told a story about me. but also was self-effacing. You know, humility is a good thing.
Yes.
And some humor and so forth. Because, you know, I'm the city attorney. Most of what I do in public is very serious. We're suing Wells Fargo. We're preventing the dumping of homeless patients. We're going after gun violence. These are not light moments. And so I can't really convey a full sense of who I am in those moments. But in this short 3-minute video, it was an attempt to say, here's a sense of the breadth of where I'm coming from.
I can be self-deprecating too.
Yeah, kind of. Well, but you know, it's interesting because I think that people in politics are very full of themselves often. And voters really want to get a sense of a person who they'd want to talk to after work one day.
Or have a beer with.
Have a beer with.
Yes, absolutely.
And who will listen. Right. Now, that's the thing, Alan. One thing about our profession in the law is talking skills are way overvalued. Listening skills in politics and in law, way undervalued. The people I want to talk to are folks who've listened to other people and whose views are shaped by the learning that happens there. I'm going to all 101 neighborhoods of the city as a candidate. That's a lot of places to go. But it's extremely rewarding because I'm going to listen. What do people really care about? Not from a gauzy TV ad somewhere, but like in a park. Right. What do you care about? Ask me anything. I'll ask you questions,
too. What have people told you so far? I know you've been campaigning. So what have they told you?
So there are some questions in common across the city. And I'm talking about going like from Watts to North Hollywood, from Lincoln Heights to Mar Vista, right? People all care about homelessness.
Of course.
They want to talk about public safety.
Yep.
They want to discuss affordable housing, the pandemic. But other questions are very specific. You know, sometimes people want to talk about, I was in Pacoima yesterday, people wanted to talk about the safety at the park there, for example. In Studio City, people wanted to focus on airport noise from Burbank to a meaningful degree.
That's been going on for a while.
But, you know, even when it comes to the broad issues that everybody talks about, let's take safety, for example. You know, I proposed increasing the police department a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
In some neighborhoods, that's the conversation. Let's have more police. When I was in South LA, I heard, I want more police, too. I just don't want to be racially profiled. You know, and it's important to hear these various perspectives because I think in politics, there's much too much us against them. And one of my key factors in running is I want to find the common ground. And there's a lot of common ground here when we try to govern a city that is in so many crises right now.
How do you balance that, though, when you talk about racial profiling and police work? How do you balance it?
I make very clear that professional law enforcement should never profile someone based on their race. We need more police officers because we're a very under-policed city. We have spikes in violent crime in particular. But there's clear opportunity for us to expand the force and have more reform. For example, sever from armed enforcement responsibilities going to a mental health incident that isn't violent on the street. That should not be done by a law enforcement person. It should be done by someone with a mental health background. Like saying to communities that often are distrustful of police, let's embed officers for 5-year stints here so people learn to trust and respect and understand each other. Let's have civilian ambassadors in police stations to demystify that experience, make it a user-friendly experience for everybody, anybody coming in. Let's de-escalate violence by training officers to reject use of force unless it's absolutely necessary. There are many reforms that are compatible with and, in fact, necessary to go with having a diverse, well-trained police force. And I think in this city right now, we need both. And by the way, on safety, we cannot turn just to the police department to solve all our public safety issues. We need to have neighborhood-based violence prevention programs. Even something I will say to, you know, you guys, that folks don't anticipate. When I'm in communities, in Philadelphia, they did a study recently. They took a dangerous neighborhood, they cut in half. On one side, they said violent and vacant and blighted properties, they were not going to touch. Other side, they cleaned them up. 29% decrease in gun violence just in the area where they cleaned up the vacant, blighted property. So I've said we're going to have 1 million more hours a year of neighborhood beautification and cleanup, not just because our city is filthy and we need to have our quality of life improved, but it'll also contribute to safety. So there are all these factors in making a comprehensive and sustainable level of safety in our city.
And you also have skin in the game when people feel like they're cleaning up their own communities. You know, people feel like they have a sense of, you know, they have a piece of it too, you know, and they have a sense of pride.
That ownership is so important. And by the way, looking at the world through the lens, you're talking about your kids, through the lens of a little kid. If you're a kid in a neighborhood and there's graffiti everywhere, and there's gun violence, and there's blight, and there isn't decent food around, and aren't good recreational opportunities, you think nobody cares about you. And we have lots of kids growing up in our city right now who feel that way. It's the obligation of the mayor to look out for all the families in this city. And one advantage of going to all these neighborhoods and having been the kind of elected official I've been, including from my days at Bethesda, going throughout the city, is having a sense of the pulse of what's happening every day on a block, as opposed to running a campaign on remote control.
Now, you're talking about symptoms as the crime, the consequences, what we see. But what I think you're really looking at is the disease, what's underlying it, and that's what you're trying to address. How, and just to Leanne's point, how do you change things underlying, which will then consequentially cause different behavior?
You know, it's such a great question, because getting to the root causes and preventing crime in the first place beats the heck out of having a victim and prosecuting them later, right? And prosecuting the offender later. So root causes, of which there are many. In many communities, there isn't access to good jobs or health care. And in that situation, the antidote is pretty clear. We need an infusion of private resources, not just public ones, into a community to create those opportunities. In some communities, there aren't meaningful after-school programs, for example, or job training. Well, that too is an imperative piece of what makes a community safer. But I think as mayor, it's imperative to have your eye on all these facets at the same time. Call my competitors are just throwing out numbers. We're going to have X number of police officers, as though that alone, just kind of raising the ante, is going to change things without this more broad-based approach. And I think that voters understand that. One thing about campaigning is, I think, and as I go around talking to folks, voters are very sophisticated. I think candidates need to give them their due.
They're smarter than most politicians give them credit for.
You bet. And I think it's really important to pay that respect.
As the city attorney, isn't it true that you've had exposure to what you're talking about on how to look at the root causes versus just rhetoric, where maybe some of your opposition is kind of stuck with?
Many, many cases, many programs, many initiatives we have are designed to do just that, Alan, because let's take just the other day, there was a piece of our work was in the news a lot. There is a large apartment complex in North Hollywood. There have been 9 shootings in 15 months in and around that property. There's a church next door. The church had to erect a metal barrier to deflect bullets from that building from coming in and interrupting youth activities at that church. So what's our approach? The police have done a lot of intervention, arresting people and so on, but that's not a sustainable level of safety to arrest after the fact. So we have gone in and sued the owner and said, you need to be changing the physical conditions and the management at this property so that there is lighting and cameras that tie into LAPD and gates that lock only residents can get in, and changes in how you're running the property and so on. Those underlying changes we have found in hundreds of cases change conditions so that a property that's a source of gangs and guns and drugs in a neighborhood is no longer a threat to the surrounding community. Underlying issues. If I could really quickly, there's a whole other set of underlying issues I want us to allude to for a second. So gun violence is up 53% in our city in the last couple of years. I've been, as you know, a leader nationally on gun violence issues. But there's another facet to this that I want to talk about for a second. We know that kids who were exposed to trauma from gangs and guns and so forth don't have their brains developed. They were biologically destined to. And so we create a program in our office designed to interrupt that deterioration in brain development that will have consequences for years to come. Now, in huge swaths of Los Angeles, we send teams, when there's just a shots fired call, of LAPD, a therapist, and a community caretaker go to the scene just looking for kids and families where the kid is aware the shot was fired, because just that awareness creates trauma. And then we offer immediate therapeutic intervention. And we train parents and teachers and administrators what to look for, so we don't end up with a generation of kids who are going to commit violent acts of their own because they were victimized this way in the first place, who are never going to fulfill who they were meant to be.
Right. Try to break the cycle.
And I just think we need more of that. We need more of that, looking at underlying causes and fixing problems before they escalate.
I'm glad you mentioned kids and the youth, because clearly that's the future, and that's where you have to start to improve what you talk about, which is LA in crisis. Now, I have to take a quick break. Folks, if you're listening, You have a couple minutes now. Don't listen to the commercials. Go to Mike for LA. You can check out the mustache. Oh, no, I'm sorry, best friend. I gave it away. Check out the best friend video. You have a couple minutes. MikeForLA.com, or you can look at where Mike tweets at Mike_Feuer, F-E-U-E-R, and check that out, and we'll see you in a couple. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio, 790 KABC. Back. We're talking to Mike Feuer. I'm Alan Gervais, and I'm here with Leanne Tweeden. If you want to call in, it's 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. Hopefully we can get to some questions. I know the board has been lighting up, but we have our own questions first.
Yes.
But feel free, if you have a question for Mike, call
ooh,
in.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
You know, we've talked about so many things, and Mike, you've mentioned immigration issues, criminal justice reform, gun violence, homelessness, just to name a few, school safety. But back in junior high school, there was a girl who heckled you.
Oh, my gosh.
And
wow.
Said,
you did a deep dive.
All you care about is sports.
Yes.
How do you make the transition from just being a singular focused guy caring about sports where all the girls are, you know, falling all over you and they just want to know if you know about anything else, and now you've expanded your horizons to all of these important issues for LA?
Yeah, you know, I've noted that youth is wasted on the young, right? There was that. Yeah, I figured out like 3 years too late what she was really trying to say to me.
That's right.
But, you know, with age comes wisdom. So what are you going to say? So but in this moment, though, it's in terms of transitions, it is the case that we have so much potential, but so many crises now. And when I say crises, I'm not exaggerating. Homelessness is not a problem. It's an emergency. Affordable housing is a crisis here right now. Everybody's on edge because of increases in violent crime. The pandemic, of course, has wreaked havoc with us from a health standpoint, but small businesses have been devastated with people losing their jobs. I cannot remember a time in the history of the city when all these issues have escalated so much and are converging with each other.
And so quickly.
So quickly, and we're at a moment where the only way to be effective right now is a leader who can step in on the first day. And this is the theme of my campaign. Based on experience as an executive leader right here in Los Angeles, step in on that first day and shake up the status quo. Because if nothing else, my career has been about shaking up the status quo in every job I've had, because I don't settle for what it was. I want to look to around the corner to what could be and then make it happen.
I have to ask you, you know, you talk about homelessness, and I think that's one thing you said. You've been going to a lot of towns and cities around LA on your campaign, and you can't drive anywhere, and it's not just Skid Row anymore. You know, you drive anywhere, small towns, you drive out in the valley, you drive, you know, West Hollywood. It doesn't matter where you go now. It's everywhere. It's prolific. It is. It's not just overpasses anymore. It's in front of schools. It's in nice neighborhoods. It's everywhere. And, you know, it's growing bigger. It's like whack-a-mole. You see an encampment be cleaned up. It's back in hours, not just next week. It's, you know, and I think people are, we are a compassionate people. You know, I think people feel sorry for people that are down on their luck, that people need help. You know, people want to help them up. But I think, you know, years of doing this show and you know, you have Prop Triple H, we have billions of dollars that have been thrown at it, and it seems like it's gotten worse. And then, you know, I see red tape.
I'm listening to you, and I'm just remembering what happened just yesterday. Yesterday, my wife unfortunately had a fall and fell on her head, and we had to go to emergency room. We're in the emergency room. I'm with my kids because it was at a birthday party of all places that it happened, with a little snow sled thing. So we're in the emergency room. My kids are sitting there. They've never been in a hospital in their lives. There's a man sitting there. They're triaging. They come to the man and they say, "Are you feeling sick?" He says, "No." And they're watching. Does anything hurt you? No. And they said, "Well, why are you here?" And he said, "I'm really depressed. I'm anxious. I'm feeling anxious." Why? He's got a little suitcase. He says, I have nowhere to go. I have nowhere to go. I came to emergency, so maybe you could put me in this hospital so I'd have a place to sleep. And my kid's jaws just dropped.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, you know, in LA, I mean, this has been going on for years now, but it's like, you know, all of the politicians, Garcetti, I mean, it just seems like we've been throwing money at it. Now this Triple H money, and, you know, it went from $300,000. Now it's above $500,000 for an apartment. I'm sorry. I did a show with McIntyre. I did a show with Dr. Drew. We've seen you put a guy in an apartment or a woman that's homeless. They're in it for a week. They're back out on the street. They tell you they have mental health issues. I mean, do you think it's a mental health problem? Because you give them an apartment, well, they're, you know, out of the apartment. They're back on the street.
You're asking the right person, because Mike has spent, I know this for a fact, so many years on this problem, and I've seen him speak about homelessness and heard him.
Right. I want to hear what you're going to do, because I don't know what a $600,000 apartment, Mike, for a homeless person is going to do, because it's gotten worse the more money we've been throwing
at it. Here's
the answer. What's happening? What are you going to do that's different?
Yeah. So, Leon, it is the question. I think it's the most important issue in the city, and I understand that voters have had it, and I agree with them. So let me walk through. My first day as mayor, I declare a state of emergency on homelessness. It gives the mayor additional executive powers. It also says to the public, not a problem, an emergency. We're treating it that way. 4 years ago, I wrote a piece for the LA Times. The piece said if we had an earthquake, we would have a FEMA field general here in charge of recovery. I wrote that we have the equivalent of that disaster. It's homelessness, and nobody's in charge. And that ruffled feathers. But look, if I gave 30 well-intentioned people a little piece of a problem to solve and had no one in charge of bringing their work together, it wouldn't get solved. I'm going to change that on my first day as mayor as well. There's going to be a person who reports only to me, a top official who consolidates all the authority of the mayor's office. That means every city department on homelessness. Next, I'm going to say to all the general managers in the city who touch homeless housing, there are about 10 of them, you want to keep your jobs in this emergency, you're going to cut the time it takes to cite and approve it, or get somebody else to do it. Next, I'm going to say we have to change our street engagement strategies. We need to be saying to people experiencing homelessness, and Leanne, to your point, we're compassionate. But there's nothing mutually exclusive about being humane and compassionate and wanting order on our streets. We can do both. And so we should be saying to the person experiencing homelessness, we have a place for you to go, because it is not safe for you here. 1,600 people died on our streets last year. Right. Not safe for you here, but our public spaces need to be safe and accessible to everybody.
And the person's business that you're sleeping in front of, that people don't go to that business anymore.
Exactly. So we give a choice date by which, and there's been some success in this approach, just little bits of time, we should be doing it much more, where we say the date is coming when you have to choose, but you can't stay here. And ideally, people will accept the housing and the services. That's happened on the Venice Boardwalk.
Yes.
That's happened
wraparound
at Penmar Park.
Services.
Yes. So I want to also focus on mental health and substance abuse. You mentioned those two things. The county, not the city, is in charge of those issues. But any official in the city who says, I'm going to abdicate that responsibility to the county, it shouldn't be in office. As mayor, I'm going to work relentlessly with city and county leaders, because we should be meeting every couple weeks. For the life of me, I don't know why that's not happening right now. Every couple of weeks to say, look, we have mental health, we have substance abuse. And on those issues, by the way, I called the doctor in charge of mental health for the county. He has said that we have an open air asylum on our streets. And I said, then why are we spending money the same way when we have different models to produce? We have 1,300 vacant substance abuse beds for addicts in the county system. Vacant.
Vacant.
Because of difference of opinion between the outreach workers on the one hand and the county on the other. So I'm going to change these things. Something else, Leanne, you mentioned. Those units are too damn expensive.
Thank you.
And so what am I going to do about it? Two things. First of all, 5-6 years ago, I was the first city official to call for converting motels into housing for people experiencing homelessness. It's existing. You don't have to build from ground up. Converting is much cheaper. And some of those motels have been nuisance properties. It's a win for everybody, and neighbors wouldn't complain about that. So I want to continue to escalate that effort. But also, I want the private sector to pick up. You know, I mentioned Triple H is a publicly funded process. There's a private sector equity funded model that builds those units for about a third the cost that the city's officials are doing it right now. I want to turn to that team and say, let's get a $1 billion private fund to do this for a third of the cost. These are just some of the things I want to do, and almost all of it on literally the first day as mayor.
Why has Eric Garcetti not been successful?
You know, I think that there is, the key issue is execution. We have to execute more effectively in City Hall. One of the advantages that I bring to this campaign is I'm the only one of the candidates who's been an executive leader in a public office running for the mayorship, which is an executive public office. I've been a legislator. I've been in the state legislature, a city councilman. Some of my colleagues who are running are in that position. Legislators have a vote, have an opinion on an issue. An executive, like I have been, has to set priorities, delegate to key people to effectuate those, give them time frames and measures of success. If they don't meet them, then you get somebody else to do it. That's what it takes to run a city. And I think that running that city that way with impatience is important, but also doing it in a way that reflects listening to the voters. What do you care about the most, priorities being the most? And let's rivet ourselves on those things. On homelessness, there is no time to lose. I recognize that I'm pretty intense about this, but I think that reflects the urgency that people in the community feel. No time to waste. We can't afford to train someone on this job. Let's go in there right now and start to take action.
What about some of your opponents? There's people like Karen Bass, Kevin DeLeon, Rick Caruso, Joe Biscaino. These are the leading candidates with you. Where are their differences? Because I watched a debate, and I'll tell you, you did very well because of your knowledge. But your opponents were kind of echoing the same things.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I have been the most detailed, focused candidate, and my website reflects that. And I've heard my opponents echo what I've said. You know, being a mayor is not about following. It's about leading. But it is true, at some point, especially because the letter F comes after the letters B and C and so on, that by the time they get to me, if they do it alphabetically, there is a certain similarity because people have borrowed my ideas. No one in the electorate cares about who started the ideas, except people do want a leader who's initiating, not just following and copying somebody's homework. Having said that, one of the key differences is my opponents, again, have been, except for Caruso, have been legislators, and that's all. This is not that job. It's an executive job. And my office won the American Bar Association's top award in the nation for a public law firm. The only time a city attorney's ever gotten that award. LA Times said that I set the standard for future city attorneys, so I know how to lead. When it comes to federal legislation, that's a very important role to play, but federal government stuff is very different from local leadership here on the ground in Los Angeles. And Mr. Caruso, of course, had the opportunity to be in the public sector.
But it doesn't matter. He's got a lot of money to spend.
He has a lot of money.
A lot of ads.
Yeah. But you know what? He's also derided public service. And I don't think that you can be an effective mayor and have that perspective on what public service is. We all made choices. You know, Mr. Caruso, for example, made the choice. He was in a big law firm to go make a lot of money as a developer of malls and luxury housing. I don't begrudge him that. That's a fair choice. But I made a different choice. I chose to try to lift people up, either in running a nonprofit for the most vulnerable people in our city or in public service, trying to change the world and make our city safer and function more effectively with a lot of success. And I think those choices count because I think voters are looking for the values that we have. What's in your character?
We got to take a break, but you don't have anything else to say about Mr. Caruso?
We'll have.
I heard he's afraid to debate. Well, why doesn't he come? And I got to be fair here. I want to tell everyone we invited Karen Bass, Kevin DeLeon, and Rick Caruso to be here today with Mike Fuhr to debate or talk about issues. They all declined. And Mike Fuhr, did you decline?
I did not.
You said bring them on.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, because I think that elections are about choices at the end of the day. And the choices here can be pretty stark when push comes to shove. There are differences of our experience. There are differences in our vision. There are differences on the approach we're going to take on day one. And voters need to be exposed to those differences so they can make an intelligent decision.
Truth be told, it's your sports background that said, bring it on.
That's right.
Welcome competition.
Exactly.
We got to take a break.
All right.
Or I won't have a show next week if I don't take this break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. And check out Mike for LA. Mike for LA, Mike_Fuhr for tweeting, and we'll be right back.
Give me the mic, please. I'm here with Mike, and I need the mic, and you're just playing the song, Wayman. Come on. I know you love this song. But I'm here with Mike Fuhr and Leanne Tweeden, and I just need the mic. I have the mic. I have the mustache right next to me. I don't know if there's a big difference between the mustache and the mic. They seem to have the same kind
of Oh, no, they've been together since the 70s. They're one and the same now.
It's like a long marriage.
Yeah.
And you have been married a long time. What, about 37, 38 years?
Yeah, 38 years. And for what it's worth, my wife has never seen me without the mustache.
Oh, wow.
We have no idea what's underneath there, by the way. Yeah. Who knows what's growing underneath there?
We don't know. But she may want one day to
see
it.
One day. Might be baby
she
skin.
She obviously endorses the mustache. Let's talk a little bit about endorsements. Yes. Is there anyone that we can say? Because I know during the break you said something to me, and I don't know if we can make that public or not.
No, you know, when it comes, no, right now, nothing has happened yet.
Right.
So, no, I will say this, that in my past elections, I had a mountain of official endorsements and so on. But this race is different because in this race, I'm a much more known commodity around town. Those endorsements are typically for validation purposes. Don't need validation right now. What I do need is to be in every community and listen to what's happening on the ground and have people understand. I was literally in a neighbor yesterday, I'm going to say in Pacoima, and the folks in the community said, you know, no one ever comes here to campaign.
Of course.
You know, and I've heard that all over town, including in other places, you know, Woodland Hills, Brentwood, wherever it might be. Candidates don't come to the neighborhood. And those are the endorsements that matter right now.
Look, do you know how long Garcetti's been in office? And there are people that still don't even know who Garcetti is.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest.
And by the way, what if he leaves early? Because he's got this appointment
now. Yeah.
What's going to happen? Any predictions?
This is how it works. So if the mayor leaves early, the city council president is temporarily the mayor.
Nuri Martinez.
Yes, precisely. And then the council chooses to appoint somebody for the duration of the term. The term, the mayor's ambassadorship has been pending for a while now, so we're getting closer and closer. His term expires in December. So we're coming pretty close to that time frame now. And we'll see what happens. In the meantime, while everybody, you know, there's a lot of speculation about when that will happen, everybody's attention is riveted here. You know, like, again, people are on edge. We have to make sure people are safe. Homelessness, got to grapple with that. So there's plenty of time to speculate about other people's situations. But right now, when I'm in communities, people want to know, tell me right now, Leanne, as you just did, what are you going to do about homelessness? And I'm there to say, these are the specific things I'm going to do. On public safety, I mentioned again, the more officers, reform, we can do that.
Curious, you know, people are talking about that because, you know, even where we live out in the valley, crime, I mean, the organized retail theft, the people are coming into malls in broad daylight. I mean, the videos that are happening over here in Woodland Hills, and they're coming in. Faces just no coverings, and they're coming in with, you know, cutting out bags and just walking out, not even running, walking out. And you're seeing in these people are recording it on their phones, and I'm just going, the audacity. And people are just, and I'm going,
the quick answer as we're running out of time?
I got it. So really,
do you back the recall of Gascon?
No, so let's go through one thing at a time. So first of all, you mentioned organized retail theft. I gave a press conference a few months ago about this. There has been a system for nonviolent crimes of what is called zero bail, which means for nonviolent offenses that people can be let out quickly. But there are crimes that I've said to the presiding judge of the court system should be exceptions to zero bail. One of them, Leanne, is organized retail theft. Another is smash and grab burglaries.
Right.
Another is auto theft. These are examples of crimes that are increasing dramatically. They're not violent offenses. And I think it's really important, again, not that money should define who stays in jail. A rich person or a poor person, it shouldn't be how much they can spend. but their danger to the society is important.
Okay, the rapid round real quick.
Yeah, so the bottom line, there should be a risk assessment done of those of folks in that situation before they're let back on the street. We should make sure they're not a danger to somebody else.
What about the recall of Gascon?
So I at this point, George and I disagree about a lot of things, including I prosecute low-level crimes and hold people accountable. He's chosen not to do that. I disagree with the idea that there should be no gun enhancements or no enhancements for gang activity. But we also, unlike any other candidate in this race, we are in the same public safety world where I, for example, just called for an 8-point plan to attack gun violence. And the county's part of that. The DA is part of that system. So in order to help keep people safe, we have to collaborate where we can. We disagree where we must. I'll let the voters decide what to do about the recall. But my principal goal as the city attorney is to keep people safe. And in order to keep people safe, I have to have a working relationship with the DA because we both prosecute in the same system.
June 7th primary. What do you need to do to advance?
Got to be one of the top two. And so that is the key thing right now is emerging as one of those top two candidates to run off in November. It is, I know from polling, it's anybody's race.
Right.
About 45% of the voters have made no decisions yet. And so it's really important for voters to listen, compare what we stand for, who has a command of the issues, who can hit the ground running on that first day. If voters compare us on that basis, it's a race I'll win.
Keep pounding the pavement.
30 seconds. Yep. What's the message?
The message is, right now, we need leadership that I can offer, experience, hit the ground running, first day, executive leadership, accomplishment, proven leadership. And last thing I'll say is every promise I have made whenever I've won any office from city council to city attorney, I have fulfilled every single one. I put a piece of paper on the board and I make sure that we have done everything I pledge because I know voters have no faith in us as politicians. I want to inspire people that we can have faith in each other. If we do that, people will engage and our city can fulfill its potential, which is remarkable, but we have to get from here to there.
Where do people have to go to support you or if they want to know more information about you?
Go to my website, mikeforla.com. You'll see a lot of information, both about my background and about what I stand for and what I've accomplished in my life.
All right, we'll do that. And you tweet at Mike_Fuhr, just in case.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mike.
This has been such a treat. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we wish you good luck. We have about 10 seconds. Tell me, what should I ask other candidates when they come on? Just kidding.
Yeah.
He took a deep breath. Did you see him?
I did.
Ooh.
That's the first time that you were speechless in an hour.
Because it was you're wearing a Dodger uniform. It's a high-hanging curveball of a question. I was about to hit it, and I ran out of time.
Dodger uniform for L.A. for my son, Hudson. Mike Fuhr, we wish you all the best, and thank
good
you
luck.
So much for accepting our invitation to come on and speak with us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for the service you perform by doing this show.
We have Jerry Springer next week. No joke, Jerry Springer. So from Mike Fuhr to Jerry Springer next Sunday.
How about
tune
that?
Tune in.
All right.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Mike.